Matthew 26, verses 45 and 46 is where we've left off. We want to finish this up. Then we'll head over to the book of John, John chapter 18. Now, you may remember from our last class that Jesus has gone to the garden. How many times does he pray?
Three.
We've noticed that Jesus positions himself to the point where he's finally down on the ground, and the prayer becomes more intense. We talked about the medical condition he may have experienced under that great psychological stress. He had sweat that was like drops of blood, and we said, and I think this is important to remember, he wasn't losing pints and pints of blood. So there definitely was something like bloody sweat, but small drops. So it was noticeable, but it wasn't something that was going to, you know, drain a tremendous amount of blood, if indeed it was blood that came from him. So he finishes up with a prayer, heads back to the disciples. They've been sleeping some, and let's look at what we have in verses 45 and 46 of Matthew 26. Then cometh he to the disciples, and saith unto them, Sleep on now, and take your rest. Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Arise, let us be going. Behold, he is at hand that betrayeth me. Now, one thing that I do want to mention before we go through the text, last week I promised that we would start the class tonight with information about the word forsaken. Don had asked about that in last week's class. If you go back and you look at that word, it's important that we, just as with any other text, that we define that from sources that help us understand biblical words rather than put our own definition there, because sometimes our own definition is not the definition that is a good Bible definition. If you go back and you look at that word that's translated forsaken, and we'll get to that later in our study of the life of Christ, it means to be left in a lurch. It means to not help someone. Now, when we use that word, we might use it in that sense. Now, we might understand the word forsaken in the sense that you turned away from me, I was suffering, and you went down the road. You would not look at me, you would not have any contact with me. And forsaken, as we use that word, can have that sense. But if that's what happened at the cross, and we talked about Psalm 22 last time, and you can read through it, and there was Brian's suggestion, which I think is good, that passage seems to have been on the minds of people. They did cite some information from it. The idea there that I see for sure with forsaken is that the Father did not step in to help. And that ties in well with the prayer that Jesus uttered, that it was going to be a very, very difficult experience. Well, that difficulty is now seen here again in Matthew 26, 45 and 46. He comes to the disciples, whatever reason he had for taking them along, very possibly that was for some kind of emotional support. He finds them sleeping, and he says a very strange thing to them. He says, sleep on now and take your rest. Well, that seems to be pretty curious, and then we'll say a little bit more about the sorrow. But it sounds like Jesus meant that sleeping and resting is perfectly fine or not so good. Sleep on, take your rest. What's that sound like? Oh, okay. The New American Standard, the ASV footnotes that a little bit. And the ASV footnote says, do you sleep on then and take your rest? It tries to put it into a question form. Some of the older translations, like the ASV and the King James, rather than, I think, maybe capturing the right sense of the text, and that is, well, you can just sleep on, do whatever you want. That's not what he was trying to say. It seems to me that when you look at the NASB or you look at some of the footnotes that we have, you have Judas, he's at hand, he's coming. And there's that great multitude that we talked about last time, we'll talk about again tonight, Matthew 26, verse 47. So do the apostles really want to sleep through this part of the ordeal? And the answer to that question was no. Let's take a look at Mark 14, verse 41. Steve, is that you? Okay. Okay, so Jesus knew what was happening. According to Mark 14:41, Jesus said he knew what had come. The hour had come, that is the time. Judas was on the way, and things were going to get very intense very soon. And then we also find, as you look at verse 42, Steve, would you read that as well?
Arise, let us be
us be gone. Behold, he that betrayeth me is at hand.
Okay. Again, we need to arise, we need to get up and go. So the idea that they were going to be allowed to sleep and everything was going to be just fine, that's not what you see. And then let's take a look, if you would, with verse 43 as well, that same chapter.
And straightway, while he yet spake, come with Judas, one of the 12, and with him multitudes with swords and staves, from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders.
Okay. This is the last point. Jesus didn't want these fellows to be napping, sleeping, because Judas was coming immediately. He was on the way. Now let's take a look at one of the passage here. We can fault the apostles for sleeping, for napping, for not being as awake as they could have been, should have been. All that's true. But I want you to see from Luke's account, this is going to be Luke chapter 22, verse 45. Dolores, that's you, isn't it? And if you've never noticed this detail before, in fairness to the apostles, you need to be mindful of this fact.
When he got up from prayer and came to the disciples, he found them sleeping, exhausted from their grief.
Okay, now think about that. He finds them sleeping. Why? They were exhausted. They were worn out from their grief. Some translations will say they were exhausted because of their sorrow. And that word which is translated sorrow, it's an interesting word. It's used 16 times in the New Testament. It is associated with a variety of circumstances. For example, back in John 16, verse 21, it's applied to childbirth. Earlier in that same chapter, John 16, verse 6, it is joined with the sorrow that you would receive from knowing that a person has died. Paul used this word also in the book of Romans, Romans chapter 9, verse 2, where he said, My heart is sorrowful. I have great grief over the fact that there are some Jews who have rejected the gospel. So as you look at Luke chapter 24, verse 45, you have what I might refer to as psychological exhaustion by the apostles. So they go with Jesus, they're willing to be with him, but they are just literally overcome at the great grief. So you can look at these guys and say, wow, they were sleeping, they were napping, how could they possibly have done that? Well, they were tired, and they were just mentally whipped. And we have that same kind of experience today. If you've lost someone who is close to you, if there is a time of great grief, you might just feel like the energy has been sucked out of you. And that's really what these fellows were going through. And yet they were willing to hang with Jesus. So on that page, looking at things from that specific standpoint, you have to say he really picked the right guy. Steve?
There's a song that we sing. We talk about Jesus being the man of sorrows. And all these things going on.
Yeah, that's a point that's never brought out. And he was a man of sorrows, but he wasn't the only one. The disciples, in many respects, were right there with him. And they also suffered to a significant degree. So great thought. Anybody else? Trace, did you want to? Okay. That it? Okay, let's flip from Matthew 26, verses 45 and 46, to the book of John. As I said, we have to move back and forth a little bit to keep the sequence of events, but hopefully, as we jump back and forth a bit, everything will flow in a very logical order. John chapter 18, and as I said, we have parallels here, Matthew 26, Mark chapter 14, Luke chapter 22. But let's look at John's account. It's going to be the main one that we need to pull from at this point. Remember, we talked about John 18, verse 1, the Kidron Valley, the brook of water there, didn't have water in it all the time. But when they got some rain, then it, of course, filled up. And we talked about the blood that would have been coming down that valley. And then we now have in verses 2 and 3, now Judas also who betrayed him. You can see how that ties in with Matthew 26, verses 45 and 46. Knew the place, for Jesus oft times resorted thither with his disciples. Judas then, having received the band of soldiers and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, cometh thither with lanterns and torches and weapons. Judas knew this area, as did the other apostles. John said that oft times, frequently, Jesus had gone there with the apostles, so Judas knew. And that word that's translated knew is expressed with a pluperfect. So he not only was familiar with this place, but he was very familiar with this location. Now, how do you think Judas knew that Jesus was going to be here? Well, now remember, that's a good question, because as you go back to the Passover meal, Judas at one point leaves, and there's no indication that he joins up with Jesus again. So Jesus has that Passover meal, and you have the teaching in John 14, 15, 16, and 17. He ends up in the garden with the apostles. Now, maybe he had picked up at some point in the meal that Jesus was going to go there. Maybe there was some strong suspicion on his, in his mind. But there's no indication why he knew that this was going to be the spot. He was, though, confident that Jesus was going to go there. And the confidence was so high that who's he take? How's it described?
The police and the soldiers and the chief priests and Pharisees.
A bunch of people. The ASV has the word band before you have the word soldiers. And that word, we alluded to this last time, that word described a complement of soldiers that if the full strength was there, you have 600 people. Now, I can't guarantee that it was a full band. They probably left some people back at the fortress to deal with some other things. But that word did mean or did describe 600 people. So you have a group which potentially could have been that large. Plus you have the officers, other officials from the chief priests and Pharisees, and you've got some other Jews that were also accompanying this crowd. So Jesus meets up with this group immediately after he finishes praying. We have that detail in Mark chapter 14, verse 43. And here's Luke's description of it. Dolores, back to you. Luke chapter 22, verse 47. Yes, please. Did I give you a wrong reference? Is that Luke 22:47?
No, that would be Luke 2.
Okay. This will help us.
While he was still speaking, suddenly a mob was there, and okay. One of the 12 named Judas was leading them. He came near Jesus to kiss him, but Jesus said to him...
Okay, I'm just going to stop you there because I wanted that first part. Thank you very much. So here's the scene. Jesus has gone. He's prayed three times. Comes back, the apostles are sleeping because of sorrow. Jesus wakes them up and says, are you still sleeping? That is, it's time to rise and go. You don't want to be sleeping through this. He said, the bad guys are coming. And as Jesus is speaking these words, as he's telling them this mob is on the way, what's Luke tell us? Luke 22, verse 47. There they are. Isn't that fascinating timing? The timing could not have been any better. The timing could not have been more perfect as far as the sequence of events. So as you start looking at the various details and piecing all the accounts together, you have to sit back and say, this is truly amazing. Now, a couple of the quick points. This word, which is translated band or cohort in John chapter 18, it's applied to some of the things. We find it a little bit later in Matthew chapter 27, verse 27. There was this band, there was this cohort when it came time for Jesus' crucifixion. Now, again, I don't believe that on that occasion you have 600 people out there. It probably was part of this group, but there definitely was a delegation. Paul was arrested in Acts chapter 21, verse 31, and there was a cohort, also some soldiers, presumably a large number of soldiers that were also involved with that. Now, as we look at Matthew's account, Matthew 26, verse 47, let's go back there for just a second. And Sherman, that's you, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And while he was still speaking, behold, Judas, one of the 12, with a great multitude.
There it is. Judas comes not just with a crowd, but Judas comes with a great crowd. Now, I'm not sure how many they had in mind when they talked about a crowd, but 20 or 30 really, to me, doesn't seem to be a crowd. But when I start thinking about hundreds of people possibly, then that to me sounds like a great crowd. So when this group comes against Jesus, if you thought it was just 4 or 5 people or maybe even 10 or 20, you might want to, based on the details, go back and rethink that because that just doesn't seem to match up very well. When you begin to look at the parallel accounts, you have the chief priest, singular, in Matthew 26, verse 47. That's plural, chief priests, in Mark chapter 14, verse 43. You have the Jewish scribes and the elders in Mark chapter 14, verse 43, and they were also all part of this mob. Anything that you want to ask before we look at some other items, Ray?
You just mentioned the big crowd that was there with the Jewish and all that, but the Romans had to be there because the Jews could not bring them to death.
Yes. Right. Unless they were going to break the law, and that probably would have gotten them into a whole lot of trouble, they did not have the right to take someone's life. So that's why they have to end up with Pilate, and likely, you know, had to get have the soldiers involved to make sure that everything went okay. So yes, they did observe at least part of the law, and had a little bit of control, but it really was a reckless procession in many ways. Anybody else? Okay, let's talk about what the people came to Jesus with. They were well equipped. In John chapter 18, verse 3, John said that they had lanterns, they had torches, and they had weapons. The word lantern and the word torch, they are both similar in meaning. They both describe something that you would see with. There is a slight difference. The word translated torch, I'll give you this description. One described it as, these were made of strips of resin-treated wood tied together. The lamps had space for oil and wicks. The word that's translated lamps would also be used in the 10 virgin teaching Jesus offered in Matthew chapter 25. Now, why do you think? You have this large number of people, and you've got a lot of light. Why do you think that they probably came with a lot of light, just like today? All right. Well, I would add a little bit more to that. But yes, I think you gave the general answer. You're probably going to engage in a search for someone. That's what you're anticipating. You've got this area. It's dark. You want to make a thorough search. You want to find the person that you're looking for. So you make sure that you have plenty of light. Today, cops are looking for somebody. They bring out the helicopter. You've got the big spotlight and so forth. Or if you have a construction worker, we drove within the last 6 months through a construction zone. And it was night, and it almost looked brighter than the day. I mean, they've got those big Hollywood lights out there, and you see them, you know, about 5 miles away, and you think, wow, you know, I can't imagine what it's going to be like when I get close to that, and hopefully they don't shine it and blind me. But they did have plenty of light. They also had some weapons. Now, John didn't get specific. He simply says that they had weapons, and that's an interesting word. It's used about six times in the New Testament, Romans 6:13, Romans 13:12, 2 Corinthians 6:7. And you may remember those passages. Paul said, don't present your bodies as an instrument of unrighteousness, but present your body as an instrument of righteousness for God. That's the same word which is translated weapon. Not that our bodies are supposed to be weapons, but they are to be tools in God's service. Matthew 26:46, and also Mark chapter 14, verse 43. Let's see what they describe these weapons as. Matthew 26:46. Sherman, you there? 26:46. That's what I had.
No, it's 47.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Okay, they came with swords and clubs.
Okay. I'll correct that. Thank you. When you think about a sword, what comes to mind? What's the first image that... Yeah. You think about the one that's about 3 feet long. But the word that's translated sword here, not so much. It would have described either a smaller sword or a large knife, which, I mean, those are still both deadly, and you probably don't want to tangle with too many people that have those. But to me, it's not saying that everybody was, you know, out there with a 3-foot sword like you might think of somebody on a ship way back when, and they were waving around those long weapons. What was a stave? Sherman kind of gave you the answer, I think, in the reading.
A stave.
Some translations we use the word stave. It was a club. Now, that's an interesting word. If you go back and you look at the word, sometimes it's translated tree. For example, Jesus was or a piece of wood. So stave can mean club, piece of wood, tree, those kinds of things. I do find it interesting, though, that that word which describes the stave or the club, in Revelation chapter 22, verse 2 and verse 14, there is the what of life. Anybody remember? There is the tree of life. Now, we wouldn't translate that the club of life. That wouldn't make any sense. But it's interesting that Jesus was approached by people who had clubs, these pieces of wood, and now, because he was willing to suffer at the hands of the mob, there is the tree of life. Anything that you want to add or ask before we look at John chapter 18, verses 4 to 6? Okay. Well, let's start with verse 4 and read down through verse 6. Jesus, therefore, knowing all the things that were coming upon him, went forth, and saith unto them, whom seek ye? They answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus saith unto them, I am, and at least in the ASV, he is italicized. And Judas also, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When therefore he said unto them, he's italicized, I am, they went backward and fell to the ground. One of the most important words in John chapter 18 is found in verse 4, and that is the word which is translated no. If you go back and you look at this word 8 times in the book of John, John uses this word to describe not just Jesus' knowledge, but he uses this word, and here is one of those eight times. We'll look at the other seven momentarily. He uses this word to describe Jesus' divine foreknowledge. Let's take a minute and go back and look at these in the class. Let's go back to John chapter 6. This is where we find it first. John 6, verse 6. As you look at the verses which lead up to John chapter 6, you've got the Feast of the Jews. That's verse 4. Jesus saw the great multitude that came to him, and he's going to test Philip. He asks Philip, verse 5, he says, we have a large number of people, and where can we buy bread that we can feed all the people? And verse 6 says, and this he said to prove him, to test Philip, for he himself, what? He knew. Jesus asked this question of Philip, how are we going to feed all these people? Where are we going to get the bread? He didn't need an answer to that question. He knew what was going to take place, but he also wanted to demonstrate his power. But he knew he had that divine foreknowledge. In this same chapter, as you move down a few verses, John chapter 6, verse 61. Let's see what we find there. But Jesus, knowing in himself that his disciples murmured at it, said unto them, does this cause you to stumble? So he knew what was going on in their minds and in their heads. So what people thought, whether that was the disciples or somebody else, it was no secret from him. And then once more in this chapter, John 6, verse 64. But there are some of you that believe not. For Jesus knew from the beginning who they were that believed not and who it was that should betray him. Now that's a statement which is really hard for us to grasp. How could Jesus know from the beginning who wasn't going to believe? How could he know from the beginning who it was that was going to betray him? Well, that was divine foreknowledge. Then as you look at this word, you also find it a little later, John chapter 13. Passover time. Now before the feast of the Passover, Jesus, knowing, there's a word again, he had that divine foreknowledge that his hour was come that he should depart out of the world unto the Father. And then you find it also in John chapter 13, verses 3 and 11. Down there in verse 3, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, that he came forth from God and was going back to the Father. Then once more in verse 11, for he knew that he should betray him. So as you start looking at what Jesus knew prior to this time, when you start looking at what happened with Jesus in conjunction with his death, none of this information was a surprise to him. In fact, as you look at John chapter 18, verse 4, this knowledge he has, it's described with a perfect tense. This isn't something that he received 5 or 10 minutes before this time. He knew this. He understood what was going to take place in the garden from, to use our language, way back when. Anything that you want to add or ask based on what we've said thus far? All right, let's make a couple of additional points. Judas had made some arrangements to betray Jesus. Anybody remember what that sign was going to be? He said, I'm going to kiss him. That's going to signal. But then there's another detail, which is one of those things where if you're not trying to piece the sequence of events together, you might miss it. Let's see what that detail is. Matthew chapter 26, 48. And we'll see what the translation says. We'll also use a King James if we need a backup. 26, 48.
Now his betrayer had given them a sign, saying, whomever it is, he is the one, seize him.
Okay. Seize him is how it's rendered there. Anybody have anything else? All right, that would be, that's the one that I was looking for. Not just grab him. You know, you might seize something, but you let it go. For example, you seize a cup and it's hot or it's cold and you let it go. But you also might grab something and you hold on for what? You hold on for dear life. And Jesus, when it came to Judas' description, Jesus was to be somebody that was grabbed and you hold on to this guy. So I find that to be a very fascinating detail when it comes to the Lord. But that was Judas's instruction. Then you have sort of a counterpart to that in the book of Mark. Mark chapter 14, verse 44. Steve, if you're there, let's take a look at that. Mark 14, verse 44. The word that we're going to point out here is used three times in the New Testament, the other two being in the book of Acts. Acts 2, verse 36, and Acts 16, 23. Let's get two helpers lined up for those passages as well. Acts 2, 36, who wants to be our aide, Gary? And then also Acts 16, 23, who wants to take care of that one? Jeff, thanks. All right, Are we ready, Steve? Mark 14, verse 44.
And he that betrayed him had given them a token, saying, whoever I shall kiss, that same is he. Take him, lead him away safely.
Okay, now as you look at that word safely, and when I just looked at that in English, I thought, well, what's that mean exactly? Does safely mean don't let him get hurt? Well, maybe, but that's where we got to go back and look at the word. So here's this word. Let's see how it's used the other two times in the New Testament. Acts 2, verse 36.
Therefore, let all the house of Israel know assuredly that God hath made that same Jesus whom ye have crucified both Lord and Christ.
Okay, let's go back to the first part of that. Let everybody know how? Assuredly. Or I want everybody to know certainly. That's that same word in Mark 14, verse 44. So when you hold on to this guy, you hold on to him, once again, for dear life. So that comes through in Matthew's account, Mark's account, but it's coming through slightly differently. And you also find this word, as I said, used in Acts 16, verse 23. Let's take a look at that, Jeff.
Acts what?
16:23. All right, there's that word again. You keep them how? You keep them safely, certainly, assuredly. You get a hold of this guy and you don't let him know. Maybe you've seen a show, maybe it was a real live police show, maybe it was a movie, where the cops got a hold of somebody and it was, we're not going to let him go. We're going to put several people around him. We're going to bind the, I'm not saying that happened to Jesus, but we're going to bind him hand and foot and maybe put something over his head. We don't want this guy to escape. And that was along the lines of what Judas seems to have been suggesting. We want to get him, I'll identify him for you, and you want to make sure that you don't have him slip out of your custody. You want to take a minute to guess why Judas might have had those things in his mind and said that?
Because Jesus had disappeared from crowds.
Yeah.
Escaped many times.
If you'd been Judas and you'd seen all the miracles that Jesus had done over a period of 3 years, if you're going to go after him, probably the last thing that you want is for him to pull one of his tricks, quote unquote, or demonstrate his power. And I think you see with this that Judas really didn't understand who Jesus was. He had just really he had really missed the boat when it came to the Lord. So really kind of fascinating as far as what must have been going through his mind. Trace?
Don't you think he had a little fear too?
There's a mixture here of cowardness and also fear. And that kind of leads me to the next point. But yes, you do see both. And he's a very interesting man. There seems to be a lot going through his head. And to say he was either 100% this, 100% that, I don't know that you can. Let's take a look at two more cross-references to help make that point. Luke chapter 22, verse 47. And then we'll also pick up with John 18, verse 5 again. Let's see, our Luke reference is going to be 22:47. There again, you have the idea. As I said, in modern times, they would be binding the hands, the feet, maybe putting something over the head. But that's exactly what they were trying to do, to make sure that he was really secure. So he had some concerns, apparently.
And you said 47.
Yes, Luke 22. I think most people are probably familiar with that detail, or they think Judas was leading the pack, but that's what the Bible specifically says. Now, Judas had made that bargain, the arrangement, let's do all this stuff, and now he's leading the group. But then, that's not all. As you look at John, moving back to our primary text, John chapter 18, verse 5, and the tense of the verb here is important. They answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus said unto him, I am he. And Judas also, who betrayed him, was doing what? Was standing with them. That word that's translated standing is, I want to double check my point here. I want to say it was a perfect tense verb. No, it's a pluperfect tense verb. Actually intensifies this a little bit. So he's willing to lead the group. He does lead the group. And now he's standing there with the group. So as far as him willing to fulfill his part of the bargain, he did. So I give him some courage, if you will, on those points. But at the same time, it also seems to me, as Teresa pointed out, that he does seem to have had some fear along the way. Again, we'll stop here for a second. Anything you want to address before we go a little more deeply into the text?
Well,
Okay. Ray, did you have a thought? Okay. All right. Unlike some people who might run or hide from their enemies, what's Jesus do? John 18, verse 4. Jesus goes. He goes to them. John said he went forth and he asked the crowd, who is being sought? Now, isn't that a little bit of an unusual question? Let's back up about 5 minutes. What was that word that we traced down? Book of John. 8 times, John uses that word, Jesus knew. All right? If he had that knowledge, does he need to go out to the crowd and say, oh, hey, who are you guys looking for? You think he knew? Absolutely he knew. So why did he say to the crowd, who are you looking for? Who's that sound like? Adam? Eve? Remember Genesis 3 verse 9? They ate the forbidden fruit. Where were they hiding? In the trees. And God comes and says, where are you? Didn't he know? Well, sure he knew. That tree wasn't going, or that bush wasn't going to hide him. But why ask that kind of question? It allows people to begin addressing the situation. We do the same thing today.
Makes them confess.
Yes. A child has broken a lamp. What did you do? Well, there's no question that Johnny or Susie broke the lamp. But we're trying to initiate a conversation and trying to discuss the matter. And that's what Jesus was seeking to do, just as God had done with Adam and Eve way back when. We also have this detail. Dolores, let's go back to you. Luke chapter 22. Let's see what we have in verse 48. Okay, I can't help but wonder if that didn't throw Judas off of his game a little bit. He had this planned out. I'm going to lead them, willing to stand by them. I'm going to give you a sign. I'm going to betray him with a kiss. You fellows need to make sure that he is kept securely, bind him well. And then Jesus comes up. It may have been, we don't know, but it may have been that Judas was thinking that Jesus and the apostles would have been sleeping when he shows up. Maybe he had hoped that that was going to make things really easy. But Jesus comes forth, and now he asks them, and specifically Judas, do you betray me with a kiss? Now, we don't know how many people answered the Lord. But if you look carefully at John 18, verse 5, Jesus asked this question, and how many answered him? They. So at least two. Yeah, more than one, obviously. So that could have been several people. So at this point, it seems like Judas may not have had as much control over the situation as he wanted. Now, if you remember, as I read through this, Jesus replied in what kind of way? He said, I am. He may be in your translation. If it's not italicized, there's a reason for that that I guess is not really clear to me. But it was, I am. And you find that kind of reaction earlier in the book of John, John chapter 8, verses 58 and 59. And when Jesus had made that reply back in John 8, how happy were the people with him? They wanted to kill him because they associated that with deity. And here, we don't know exactly how the people might have received that. John does say in John chapter 18, verse 6, that after that short and powerful reply, the crowd, the mob, fell backward and went to the ground. So we'll discuss in a minute a couple of possible reasons for that, but he did give a very powerful reply. What do you think that the crowd may have fallen backwards? I mean, if you have, remember what we said earlier, you've got at least dozens, possibly hundreds of people out here. The top estimate would be maybe 1,000, which I think that's probably way over the top, but even if you had just 300 or 400, it's still a sizable, it's that great crowd described by Matthew. Well, I'll give you an easier question first. Did everybody in the crowd fall over? No, you wouldn't have to understand the language that way. When somebody says the people in the crowd tripped, that doesn't necessarily mean that every person tripped, but there were a noticeable number who tripped. So it wouldn't have to conclude that everybody in the crowd fell backwards, but at least some did. Now, whether that was several or whether that was everybody, it could have been everybody. Why do you think that happened? What would our two options be? Well, okay, it could be a non, I'm going to use non-miraculous, but it could have been a non-miraculous reason, fear. I mean, you're after this guy, you've got all the lights out there, you've got the clubs, and you've got the short swords and the knives and so forth, and here's this guy coming out to meet you, and it's kind of like, kind of wonder what he's got planned. I mean, this is not what we expected.
I think when he says, I am he, that indicates that he's part of God.
Yes.
God, and they're fearful of that.
And that could have shocked them too, as far as, whoa, that's not what we expected to hear. And will something happen? Will an angel show up or God strike us dead? It definitely was not the reaction I think that they had anticipated. So fear from a couple of different perspectives might have been possible. Shock. You could also, I think, add that as a possibility. Could it have been miraculous? Yeah. But if it were miraculous, my question would be why? What did God hope to accomplish, or what did accomplish, or what was accomplished by pushing these people backwards? And that's a question that I do not have a real good answer for. So it could have been miraculous. I sort of lean towards the view that Ray mentioned, that it may have been the shock and the value factor, especially with his statement, I am. That to me seems to make a lot more sense. Let's pick up with verse 7, and then we'll see if there's something that you want to interject. That last passage says, again, therefore, he asked them, whom seek ye? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. The word again is important, and the crowd gives the same answer, Jesus of Nazareth. It is now at this point where Judas either tries to kiss the Lord or does kiss the Lord. More about that in a minute. Let's stop now and see if you have anything you want to add or ask. Trace?
Well, not everybody would have been right there in the front center.
Right.
So they suddenly step backwards, which would kind of cause like a domino effect, because it is dark and they are
right.
Not familiar with their surroundings. So, yeah, some of them are going to fall to the ground. It just seems...
Yeah. Yeah, and again, if that was a non-miraculous cause, that there was either shock or fear, and you have to remember, too, if you have people carrying around knives and some small swords, and they've got a torch, you're already sort of, at least you should be sort of cognizant of that, and you have people starting to fall and trip, safety should be on the mind. I can get burned, or I can get stabbed. So trying to kind of get out of the way of everybody, that's not difficult to see. And again, I think you could even relate that to the miraculous. If God knocked them back, then unless he was also going to miraculously protect them from being poked or burned and so forth, that gets kind of messy as far as trying to explain that. So you might add that in for additional support of a non-miraculous act.
Is this not unlike the time when he was, I guess for the want of a better phrase, backed up against an obstruction, and instead of being taken at that time, simply walk through them, and there was no action or reaction from them. I would tend to believe that when he said, I am, they were somewhat afraid of him to start with. The fact that they took a multitude with them indicates that they had certain
yeah.
fear of him. Anyway, and for him to just, with the authority that Jesus could say such a thing, would be something that would make those, especially close to him, just simply back away from him.
Yeah, aside from the miraculous powers that Jesus had demonstrated, you want to remember, too, that Jesus presumably would have been with the 11 apostles. If I were in that group, I would have assumed that we're going to get 12 guys. It's dark. Who knows? I mean, if, you know, Jesus had talked about being taken and so forth, and Judas had probably warned them, and I think, you know, grab him securely, those kinds of things. Knowing that there were 12 guys that you might face, having that size of a force probably contributed to some of the fear as well, that we don't know if these guys are willing to fight, we could have a very difficult time. So yes, I do think those are important considerations too. Betty? I think you've got to put that in here because, again, you've got this great force and you come out against this guy and he comes out to meet you. Who are you looking for? It's me. Who are you looking for? It's me. Unless he's a crazy guy, you would think that he's holding some kind of card. And it's got to be a little spooky if you are in the mob. And then you've got Peter who, you know, pulls out the sword and that certainly might have increased tensions a little bit. So it really must have been a very interesting time and somewhat scary for all involved. Anybody else? Brian?
I think it's very interesting how that when Jesus asked, they respond, Jesus of Nazareth. And again, he asked, Jesus of Nazareth. I mean, Nazareth is a long way from Jerusalem.
Yeah.
He's got a reputation. It sort of reminded me of what Paul said to Agrippa. These things weren't done in a corner.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is well known what was going on here.
Yeah.
Or at least it became well known.
Yeah, all the players were very clear.
Are you going to bring up why you mentioned why he asked again? Or should I ask a question about that?
Let's take it from a question perspective.
Okay. I have this visual of what happened. He responded the first time, and then they kind of, like you said, they kind of stopped in their tracks, lost their balance maybe a little. Hey, am I going to fall on a sword? So they kind of fall down. But then do they kind of regain themselves and they're in shock? So then they're just standing there, and Jesus is like, what are you doing? So he has to say, whom you seek ye? Again, he has to ask them, and so they say it. Jesus is like kind of not goading them on, but like...
Well, I know that as you frame that question, you may not have intended to use the word goad, but let's kind of use that as a central point. Heaven's plan was for him to die. And if all these, I don't think they would have packed up and gone home. But had they not followed through, heaven's plan might have gone a much different direction, or it may not have gone the direction that it needed to go. So it was important for these people to follow through with what they wanted. Judas was going to be the betrayer. Jesus had given some information about him, and this was the way that things needed to flow. So if there was any hesitation, Jesus also, what you're going to do quickly. He had already said that to Judas and so forth. So this was, from what I can tell, heaven's plan. And if it looked like there was going to be any kind of hesitation, withdrawing, this is what you guys have come for. So if you need a little prompting from me, I like the word prompting versus goading. But if you need some prompting from me, then I'm going to make sure that I have clearly identified myself. And I'm not going to run from you. If you have come here to get me and take me, here I am. So, man up, come back, stand up, whatever it might be, and we're ready to rock and roll.
Well, it may have also been in order to clarify the fact that the apostles weren't involved in it. They were, but not in what the mob was there for. And so by asking the second time and they're answering, we're after you, then he could say, let them go then.
Yeah, and you do see that element. We haven't gotten quite that far yet, but you do see Jesus trying to offer some protection for the apostles. And that also might be built in to the question and the answer that we're looking at with Gary's point just a minute ago, that he wants the attention to focus on him. I'm the one that you want. I'm the one that you need. And these other fellas, at least for the short term, that was distressing that they left. But still, it was important that they stayed safe. And Jesus was able to lay down his life, quote unquote, at this point to accomplish that, and did. So he sort of fell on the sword, so to speak, so that they could escape. Anybody else? Right?
Just one quick